Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
Thanks to you at home for joining this hour. It's really good to have you here on this Friday night and what has been just an incredible, incredible news day. Today, among a million other things, today, for just about an hour and a half, Kamala Harris was the acting president of the United States. Now, having an acting president, this is something that has happened previously between other presidents and vice presidents. Most recently, during the George W. Bush administration, it happened twice when President George W. Bush got put under, had anesthesia in order to have colonoscopies. Dick Cheney was acting president for each of those times for a couple of hours. Under Ronald Reagan as well, in 1985, George Bush Sr., Vice President Poppy Bush, he was acting president for about 8 hours while Reagan had surgery for colon cancer in 1985. Well, today it was just under an hour and a half while President Biden had a colonoscopy as part of his annual physical. The White House then released a long, detailed readout from President Biden's doctor about his health and everything they looked at in his physical. We learned, or at least had confirmed as current, the fact that the president takes a blood thinner, also a cholesterol drug. He takes over-the-counter allergy medicine. He has a little bit of reflux. He takes Pepcid for. The doctor said he noticed President Biden has been clearing his throat more often. And so he explained in great detail how they looked into that very, very closely and from every possible angle using tons of specialists. In the end, they decided it's just from the reflux and the Pepcid should be fine. The doctor also said that President Biden's walk, his gait, seems stiffer than it used to. The doctor explained that they looked into that very closely, too, with a gazillion different types of specialists and a ton of different types of tests of every type. And the verdict on that one is nothing's wrong, really. He's got a little arthritis in his spine. I've got that, too. He might have changed his walk a little bit to compensate when he broke his foot earlier this year. And sometimes that can change people's gait a little bit. But the doctor says the foot fracture healed fine. He's fine. There's nothing else wrong. They might want him to start wearing orthotics in his shoes, which might help with his foot positioning. And he got his contact lens prescription tuned up. That's basically it. You can read it yourself if you care to. He works out 5 days a week or more. Man, the bottom line, honestly, is that we know a lot of detail about President Biden's health. And perhaps more importantly, given what all that information is, which is not alarming in any direction, perhaps more importantly, the thing that this means today is that we're back to having normal reports on a president's health. A president's health, I mean, because he's president, by definition, is not a private matter. We all get to know as a matter of, I don't know, prying and also potentially national security, right? Presidents' health and their checkups and their annual physicals and all this stuff, it's basically public information. And it's just sort of nice to return to the system where we actually get to know. We get candid, detailed reports from a doctor who doesn't seem like a crazy person. President Biden's immediate predecessor, you may recall, the man who very nearly died in office when he contracted COVID and had to be hospitalized with blood oxygen levels so low they considered putting him on a ventilator. Nevertheless, under that president, we got these public-facing reports about his health that were basically a joke or at least a farce. Remember, he could live to be 200 years old. He has great genes. Some people just have great genes. The healthiest individual ever elected to the presidency, right? Never mind that he's, you know, clinically obese. He has heart disease we don't talk about. We're lying about his height. And also, he almost died in office from a communicable disease he may very well have spread to others. Like, to the extent that we're allowed to know stuff about president's health, now we are back to relatively normal, not insane public pronouncements in great detail about the president's actual health. After her brief hour and a half long stint as acting president today, the first woman to ever have that role, even if it just was for just over an hour. After that stint today, Vice President Harris spoke with reporters on the tarmac as she was due to fly from Ohio back to D.C. It's just brief remarks, and she wasn't asked, but she volunteered this observation on the not guilty verdict in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial today in Wisconsin.
About the verdict, and the verdict really speaks for itself. As many of you know, I've spent a majority of my career working to make the criminal justice system more equitable, and clearly there's a lot more work to do. Thanks.
Thanks, all.
Madam Vice President, people are calling it systemic.
Vice President Kamala Harris speaking with reporters today, saying the verdict speaks for itself. I've spent a majority of my career working to make the criminal justice system more equitable. Clearly, there's a lot more work to do. We've had eyes on a number of cities, also a number of places in Wisconsin tonight, not knowing whether there might be protests in response to the Rittenhouse verdict. We are seeing, as you can see in these shots, a considerable sized crowd in Brooklyn, New York, and there are some other protests in other parts of the country tonight. We're going to be going live to Kenosha, Wisconsin in just a few minutes as that city continues to absorb the Rittenhouse trial verdict. And now the knock-on effect of Republicans and far-right groups, including white supremacist groups and neo-Nazis and militia groups, holding up this young man, Kyle Rittenhouse, as not just a person who was acquitted of murdering two people and shooting a third. They've made him their new hero on the right for admittedly killing those people and getting away with it, which raises all sorts of questions about the safety of public protest in the future. One response that I think is really very much worth hearing today in its entirety is from the family of one of the people who Kyle Rittenhouse killed. The parents of Anthony Huber put out a statement today in response to the verdict. They said, quote, "We are heartbroken and angry that Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted in his criminal trial for the murder of our son, Anthony Huber. There was no justice today for Anthony or for Mr. Rittenhouse's other two victims. We did not attend the trial because we could not bear to sit in a courtroom and repeatedly watch videos of our son's murder, and because we've been subjected to many hurtful and nasty comments in the past year. But we watched the trial closely, hoping it would bring closure. That did not happen. Today's verdict means there's no accountability for the person who murdered our son. It sends the unacceptable message that armed civilians can show up in any town, incite violence, and then use the danger they have created to justify shooting people in the street. We hope that decent people will join us in forcefully rejecting that message and demanding more of our laws, our officials, and our justice system. Make no mistake, our fight to hold accountable those responsible for Anthony's death continues in full force. Neither Mr. Rittenhouse nor the Kenosha police, who authorized his bloody rampage, will escape justice. Anthony will have his day in court. No reasonable person viewing all of the evidence could conclude that Mr. Rittenhouse acted in self-defense. In response to racist and violent calls to action from militia members, Mr. Rittenhouse traveled to Kenosha illegally armed with an assault rifle. He menaced fellow citizens in the street. Though he was in open violation of a curfew order, Kenosha police encouraged him to act violently. Kenosha police told militia members they would push peaceful protesters toward the militia so the militia could, quote, deal with them. Soon after, Mr. Rittenhouse killed Joseph Rosenbaum. The police did nothing. Concerned citizens confronted with a person shooting indiscriminately on the street stepped in to stop the violence. Anthony was shot in the chest trying to disarm Mr. Rittenhouse and stop his shooting spree. Still, the police did nothing. Mr. Rittenhouse continued to shoot, maiming Gage Grosskreutz. The police let Mr. Rittenhouse leave the scene freely. Mr. Rittenhouse came to Kenosha armed to kill. Kenosha police encouraged him to act violently, and our son is dead as a result. We are so proud of Anthony. We love him so much. He's a hero who sacrificed his own life to protect other innocent civilians. We ask that you remember Anthony and keep him in your prayers. Again, that statement tonight from the parents of Anthony Huber, one of the two men who were shot and killed by Kyle Rittenhouse in Kenosha last year. Mr. Rittenhouse was acquitted on all charges today. We're going to have more live from Kenosha coming up in just a couple of minutes. I should also tell you, though, that there is more to come in terms of these gut-wrenching, harrowing trials. And I mean more to come in very short order, more to come quite soon. Right now, the jury is out. We are waiting on a verdict right now in Charlottesville, Virginia, where two dozen neo-Nazi and white supremacists and individuals and groups are facing a civil trial that accuses them of planning the violence that happened at the right-wing white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017. As I said, the jury is out. They held deliberations today. They'll be back to start deliberating again on Monday, and we will be awaiting the jury verdict in that trial. Also, the jury has not yet got the case, but closing arguments are due to start on Monday. In the trial of the three men accused of chasing down and shooting to death Ahmaud Arbery, an unarmed black man who was jogging in his neighborhood. In that case, you should know, the defense counsel keeps moving that the judge declare a mistrial in that case. Now, this is something we've been covering over the course of this week. This is the defense lawyer who said that all black pastors should be banned from being anywhere near the trial because black pastors in particular, are intimidating. He has continued all week long, including today, with that kind of rhetoric. And he's now pretty clearly upping his game and making more and more obviously racially charged remarks in open court, even as the judge calmly keeps dismissing all these repeated motions. The strategy of the defense counsel in the Arbery case really does appear to be to try to up the temperature, to try to up the racially inflammatory and, frankly, infuriating language inside the courtroom so much that it provokes a response in the community, which he could presumably then cite as a reason the trial should be called off as a mistrial. His language started off at the beginning of the week, like sort of throwing everybody back in their seats. Like, is he really saying that black pastors are a problem? Not just pastors, but black pastors are the problem? It's escalated since then. Every day this week, he has used language that's not just that provocative, but increasingly more provocative with each day. And it does, I say this not as a lawyer, as an observer, it does seem possible that what he is trying to do is stoke so much upset around that trial that he provokes something that he can use to end the trial and thereby get his client off. I mean, we shall see. But, you know, if you think that the Rittenhouse case has stoked the worst in America in the Ahmaud Arbery trial, the defense strategy really does appear to literally be to try on purpose to provoke violence, preferably along racial lines. It is getting uglier and uglier in that case. The jury should get that case very soon. Again, the closing arguments are going to begin in that case on Monday. So we have been through a lot as a country. We are about to go through a lot more. That said, as I mentioned at the top, there is enough news going on right now that it felt today like we've been trying to put 10 pounds of news in a 5-pound bag. Just tonight, the CDC, for example, has approved COVID vaccine booster shots for all American adults. We knew things were heading this direction, but now it's official. If you had your Pfizer or Moderna two shots, and that was more than 6 months ago, it's now time to go get your third shot. It's now time to go get your booster. If you had your Johnson & Johnson single shot vaccine like I did, no matter when you got that vaccine, it's time to go get a second shot. It's time to go get your booster. I talked here on the show about the fact that I did the Johnson & Johnson. The single shot vaccine is my initial vaccine back in the spring. I have now had my booster. I got a Pfizer booster. It was fine. I hate needles with enough fire and fury to burn up the sun. But I did it. I got my booster. I feel much safer. You got to do it. Even if the whole idea of a needle makes you want to throw up, even if the word makes you want to throw up, which is a little bit true for me, you have to do it. Everybody needs to be vaccinated in the first instance. If you already got vaccinated with Pfizer or Moderna more than 6 months ago, or if you're vaccine was Johnson & Johnson at any point, you got to get a booster. We can do this. If I can do it, you can do it. But that recommendation, all adults get their boosters. That happened tonight. All of that stuff all happened in today's news. I mean, plus the news that we woke up to this morning that itself would be big enough to drive a whole news cycle or 10. I mean, when we last left our main characters under the Capitol Dome this time last night, the Republican leader in the House, Kevin McCarthy, had been speaking nonstop for a couple of hours. This time last night, he'd been talking for a couple of hours already, trying to delay the passage of President Biden's Build Back Better bill. This is the bill that, you know, makes it so people who take insulin won't have to pay more than $35 a month for insulin. It extends the child tax credit that millions of American families are now getting. It gets your hearing aids covered if you're on Medicare. Medicare will cover hearing aids now. It makes all the post office vehicles and the school buses and even the trash trucks electric. It covers preschool for every kid in the country. And finally, childcare help and. It's this huge bill that is going to potentially be transformative in this country in terms of the way most American families live. Well, this time last night, when last we left our heroes in the House, the Republican leader had spoken for a couple of hours, thereby delaying the vote on the bill. By this morning, when he finally quit, he had gone on for more than 8.5 hours speaking on the floor of the House. And good for him. Aside from, you know, the content of his speech, which doesn't bear much, shouldn't require too much of your time. Frankly, as a tactic, long speeches, very, very, very long speeches, are a tried and true way for legislators to dramatize and draw attention to their objections to something that is going to happen anyway, and that is what he did. But he did that until after 5 in the morning, and then they reconvened the House in the 9 a.m. hour, and it was clear very quickly that that part was over. Over with an exclamation point.
On this vote, the yeas are 220, the nays are 213, the Build Back Better bill is passed.
The Democrats cheering and literally jumping up and down, celebrating the passage of this huge piece of legislation that they tied themselves up in such knots about. Ultimately, and this went on for a while, they finally calmed down a little bit, only to actually start back up again when Speaker Pelosi left the dais. She walked down to be with the rest of the House Democrats, whereupon they started up again. Although this time, what they started chanting was, Nancy, 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 Nancy. The bill is passed. Nancy Pelosi got it through the House with the slimmest of margins to spare. And now, of course, it goes to the Senate, where we'll see. I think it is news and important to know that the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, told us confidently here on this show last night that this bill is going to pass the Senate and that she has personally been speaking with the senators who will make the difference as to whether or not this passes. And you know who we're talking about. She told us that some things will probably come out of the bill. Perhaps some other things will go into the bill. It will change in some small ways. But she told us last night confidently that the vast majority of this bill has been, in her words, pre-conferenced, which means pre-agreed to by senators, including with conservative Democrats Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, the two who have been derailing this process all along and slowing this thing down all these months. She says they have already pre-agreed to almost everything that is in the bill, and the things that will be added to it or will come out of it are small compared to what will stay. Hearing that from Pramila Jayapal, she has been trustworthy and her assessment of these things along the way has been true. We shall see. But the Democrats celebrated today. The president celebrated it today, right after he got out of his colonoscopy, the poor guy. It's just been a really big news day. And we're going to talk about a lot more of these things over the course of this hour. But I just want to give you one other thing from today's news, which is in addition to all of that stuff, and which is a total surprise. This is something we have been covering now for months and months and months. And it feels like I think it's finally going to get done. You know, the post office guy left over from the Trump years, I mean, nobody's ever had to know the name of the Postmaster General before, right? This is a technocratic job. It has never been a high-profile job before because it has not been a controversial job before until the Trump years when we got Postmaster General Louis DeJoy, a major Trump donor, major Republican donor with no post office experience whatsoever. Since he's been Postmaster General, he has, however, distinguished himself by, among other things, being under FBI criminal investigation for allegedly using the company he previously ran to gin up hundreds of thousands of dollars in illegal Republican campaign contributions, which, among other things, appear to have positioned him to get this postmaster job. He has also distinguished himself by maintaining personal financial investments himself with companies doing business with the post office while he's been running the post office. That doesn't seem good. He's also distinguished himself by doing everything one human could conceivably do to sabotage the actual post office so it doesn't work anymore, including ordering the irreversible physical destruction of multi-million dollar custom-built mail sorting machines. He actually came up with a plan, a 10-year plan, by which he promises he will make the post office provide fewer services and be permanently slower and be permanently more expensive. And that's not if the plan goes wrong, that's if the plan works. This year, he's instituting a special Christmas time extra rate hike on top of the price hikes he's already pushed through. A Christmas season rate hike just for this year to make your holiday season this year that much harder. That's on top, I should mention, of what his changes did to the post office last Christmas, when last holiday season, on-time non-local mail delivery dropped in this country to its lowest recorded performance ever, 38% on time last holiday season under Louis DeJoy. 38% on time? If you were a student, you could add 30 points to that and it would still get you an F. Louis DeJoy is like a little bit of boiled shrimp sewed into the hems of the curtains when the last crew left the White House. A little bit of sugar poured into the gas tank, right? A little rich topsoil they carefully blended into the ground coffee before they closed up the place and handed over the keys to the Biden administration. And the reason they were able to leave him behind, what's that smell? Is because President Biden can't fire Louis DeJoy. That's not the way the post office is structured. The White House has repeatedly made clear that they'd like to. They think that he is not the man for the job. But the way it's structured, it's not the president who appoints that person. It's the Postal Board of Governors who hires and fires people for the postmaster job. Now, the president puts people on the Postal Board of Governors, but he can't directly do what they do. Well, today, on top of everything else that happened today in the news, today, in a surprise move, President Biden made the changes to the Postal Board that apparently are finally going to clear the way to getting rid of that guy. The Washington Post broke the news this afternoon, explaining it in, I think, the clearest terms. They said, quote, President Biden on Friday, today, announced plans to nominate two new officials to the U.S. Postal Service's governing board, replacing key allies of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy. The move was a surprise to postal officials and even to members of Congress, according to three people with knowledge of the matter. The move casts doubt on Louis DeJoy's future at the Postal Service. It potentially gives the panel two crucial votes to oust him, who can, of course, only be removed by the board. Surprise! Joining us now is Illinois Congressman Roger Krishnamurti. He is on the Oversight Committee that's been investigating DeJoy and his helming of the Postal Service. Congressman Krishnamurti has been calling on the Postal Service Board of Governors to fire Mr. DeJoy for months now. He's also been calling on President Biden to replace members of the Postal Service Board, which President Biden did today, so that the new board could replace Mr. DeJoy. He also introduced a bill called the Delivering Envelopes Judiciously On Time Year-Round Act, which is as awkward as it sounds, except it spells out DeJoy. It's called the DeJoy Act to fix the things in the Postal Service that Louis DeJoy has deliberately broken. Congressman Krishnamurti, I really appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Rachel.
From the DeJoy Act to your involvement in the Oversight Committee's oversight of this matter, to your direct pleas to President Biden to please replace members of the Board of Governors so that DeJoy can be gotten rid of, you've been really, really, really focused on this, perhaps more than anybody else in government. Did you know that President Biden was going to do what he did today?
I didn't. But, you know, my pleas really came from my constituents, Rachel. We've received more complaints, thousands of complaints about slower mail delivery and raised prices than perhaps any other issue that we talk about in government. And now we're on the verge of the holidays. And unfortunately, the Postmaster General is taking the joy out of the holidays, too. So it was time to call for his removal. And once Mr. Bloom refused my plea to remove Mr. DeJoy, I asked that the president also remove Mr. Bloom, who's the chair of the Board of Governors, which he announced today.
What sort of timeline do you think that people should expect here? As you say, your constituents have been giving you more feedback on this than any other issue. A lot of Americans, people who run small businesses, people who just use the mail for normal bill paying and correspondence, a lot of Americans, millions of Americans, have been really mad about how bad the Postal Service has been under his leadership. And it is apparently all by design. It is what he has set out to do and what he's done. If you can speak directly to Americans right now who have been mad about this or have been hurting about this, what would you expect in terms of the timeline for getting rid of him and starting the process of undoing some of what he's done?
Well, first of all, I think it's not going to necessarily be done before the holidays, because I think that Mr. Bloom has until the end of the year to complete his term. And so, you know, I hope that everybody sends their holiday cards and packages early this year, because unfortunately, even first-class mail is slow by 30% at this point. However, in the new year, I'm hoping that the new chair of the Board of Governors conducts a vote with regard to Mr. DeJoy and relieves him of his duties. And so I'm very hopeful that happens sooner rather than later in the new year.
Let me also ask you about the huge news today out of the House. The final passage of the Build Back Better bill, at least in the House, it will head now over to the Senate. A lot of people, I think, looking in from the outside who support the legislation are happy that it finally got there, but I think are a little spooked at how difficult it was, how long it took, how much fighting there was among Democrats to get this far, to get to this point today. Now that you're there, now that you got this legislation across the finish line, and I know you're a strong supporter of it, how do you feel about how this went and any sort of lessons learned?
I think the biggest lesson is that, unfortunately, the Republican Party has become the party of no with regard to so many priorities of our constituents, whether it's affordable child care or investing in workforce training or universal pre-K or even fighting climate change. And so we have to basically come together as a caucus and do the hard work of governing the country. The only challenge is to make sure that as we do that hard work, you know, no individual group of people take it upon themselves to exert their leverage and make it harder for us to get to a final passage of such an important piece of legislation. But now we're there, Rachel. I say this BBB Act gets a AAA rating from most of the constituents I talk to, given what's in there. I say the AAA stands for Addressing America's Aspirations. And people are really excited.
Illinois Congressman Raja Krishnamurthy, again, who has been sort of playing point on this issue about Louis DeJoy, left over from the Trump years, still helming the Postal Service, doing a job that is infuriating and inconveniencing millions of Americans of every stripe. Now looks like he may be on his way out, something the congressman has been calling for. Sir, it's been a huge day today. Thanks for helping us talk about it and understand at the end of this long day.
Thank you, Rachel.
All right, we got much more ahead tonight. Stay with us.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations, and they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
This was the scene outside a courtroom in Kenosha, Wisconsin today when Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted of all charges for killing two men and shooting another last summer in Kenosha during protests against the police shooting of a man named Jacob Blake. There was a burst of celebration from some of Rittenhouse's supporters when the verdict was read. There were groans and screams of disappointment from others in the crowd. That's what it looked like outside. Inside the courtroom, the family and loved ones of the two men Rittenhouse killed, Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber, they reacted to the verdict with tears. Joseph Rosenbaum's fiance said, quote, "I feel like in this case, the victims' lives don't matter." As I mentioned, Mr. Rittenhouse shot those three people during a protest last summer over the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Today, Jacob Blake's uncle spoke to reporters outside the courtroom. He said he was disappointed in the verdict, but also that he was not surprised by it. He said, in his view, the judge put his hand on the scale from day one in favor of the defense, in favor of Kyle Rittenhouse. The NAACP Legal Defense Fund put out a statement that said this in part today. He said, quote, "We should not forget that these killings took place amid protests in Kenosha. The history of protest is integral to the fight for racial justice in this country, and there remains a concerted attack to encroach on this right. Rittenhouse's conduct must be understood within an environment in which armed militias and vigilantes are acting to silence protesters." And tonight we have seen protesters back on the streets in Brooklyn in the largest numbers, but also some in Chicago and also some in Kenosha in response to the verdict that came down today. Joining us now is Shaquille Brewster, NBC News correspondent. Shaq has been at the Kenosha courthouse since the trial started. He was there to see the crowd's reaction today when the jury delivered its verdict. He's still there tonight out in the cold. Shaq, thanks very much for being here. I know it's been a really, really long day.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
So what is it like in Kenosha right now? I mean, the town saw those weeks of protests last year, including the violence that resulted in these this trial. Protesters and supporters of Rittenhouse have been back in Kenosha for this trial. What's the atmosphere been like?
Well, really, Rachel, despite the fears and concerns and anticipation as we watched deliberation stretch into 4 days, more than 24 hours, the jury was in that courtroom deliberating. Kenosha is calm tonight, and that is much the relief of many people here in this community. We mentioned and we've been talking about the National Guard that has been on standby, the schools that switched to virtual learning in anticipation of this verdict. And you're just not seeing that real reaction here on the streets. And I'll tell you, in my conversations with protesters and demonstrators over the course of the week, and especially today, which, by the way, on the courthouse, you mentioned that moment when the verdict was read. On the steps of the courthouse, you had people who were demonstrating against Kyle Rittenhouse and people who were calling for his acquittal. And the conversation that I had with those who were disappointed by this result, those who were calling for his conviction, they said that they expected this result. They were resigned after watching the trial. This was not a surprise to them. And I think that goes into the reaction that you saw. There was definitely disappointment that you saw in the steps, even including among Jacob Blake's uncle, Justin Blake. There was that disappointment there, but it wasn't true surprise. And I think that is partially explaining why you have that more muted feeling here in Kenosha right now. And this feeling that so many people have told me, they're just tired. They've gone through a lot the past 15 months with the shooting of Jacob Blake, with the shooting that then led to this trial, and now this trial, they've gone through a lot, and they're just tired. They're exhaling right now, as one protester put it to me, and that's kind of what you're seeing, and that's the feeling that you have here outside the courthouse, Rachel.
I have to tell you, just anecdotally, that resonates. I mean, watching, because there's cameras in the courtroom, which is a controversial thing, because the whole country has been riveted by this trial, because in large part because of the way the judge ran the trial and the judge's own statements and at times outbursts and the way that it ran. I think the trial ran in a way that was surprising to a lot of people. But the conclusion based on the way the trial was run was that it would be almost unimaginable for Rittenhouse to be convicted, at least of the most serious charges. So I think anecdotally that resonates in terms of why the why the response has been what it has been. I don't know anybody who didn't expect this acquittal today. But, you know, Shaq, I wanted to ask you about the victims' families. We saw Joseph Rosenbaum's fiance today say, in this case, I felt like the victims' lives don't matter. What else have you heard, if anything, from the families of the two men who were shot dead by Mr. Rittenhouse?
Yeah, and you read earlier in your show that really compelling statement from the family of Anthony Huber, who really just said and expressed their disappointment at the result. There was another statement from Rosenbaum and from Gage Grosskreutz, who was injured in the shooting with Kyle Rittenhouse. And in that statement, they say that night in Kenosha, Gage and Anthony Huber and many others acted heroically. They did not seek violence, but they sought to end violence. And what we need right now is justice, not more violence. They say, while today's verdict may mean justice delayed, it will not mean justice denied. And that is the sentiment that you heard from the families as they were leaving the court. I mean, one thing to point out, Rachel, is that these are families who have expressed frustration over the course of the trial, that they didn't feel like their loved ones were being defended or represented in the courtroom very well. I mean, at one point, you even had the prosecution go after Rosenbaum, who was a victim here, who lost his life in that shooting. And he said he was he had something along the lines of had a Napoleon complex, who was going after someone who was even smaller than him. And, you know, that language, it was hard for the family to sit there. Of course, that's the prosecution did that because that was part of their case. That was part of what they thought would work for the jury. But the families definitely had to go through a lot. And it's definitely a heartbreaking experience for them and to see them in their reaction. We do know that as the verdict was being read, they were crying and they were holding each other as that moment happened. It's definitely a situation where you don't have any real winners here in terms of when you acknowledge the fact that two people did lose their lives and one person was seriously injured.
Yeah. And the consequences in terms of what this is going to mean to the country, in terms of how people are able to safely protest or even angrily protest, but legally protest against things. The idea that this is going to have an effect in terms of whether or not people feel safe and able to do that. Also, the prospect that there could be civil suits that happen that follow up on this criminal case. There's a lot still to come. This is going to resonate for a long time. Shaquille Brewster, NBC News correspondent with us from Kenosha tonight. Shaq, thank you. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
All right. We've got more ahead. Stay with us.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Okay, this is something you should see. As you know, this week, the House took this very rare step of voting to censure one of its members. Republican Congressman Paul Gosar of Arizona censured and stripped of his committee assignments because he posted a video online which showed him killing Democratic Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. In the lead up to that vote this week, it was a pretty compelling presentation. Among other things, we saw very powerful speeches from the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, and from Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez herself, talking about the consequences of normalizing violence against members of Congress, particularly in this environment. But it should also be noted that in the lead up to that vote, we also heard from a number of Republicans who defended and excused what Congressman Gosar did. Colorado Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert then took it one step even further. She didn't just defend Congressman Gosar, but she decided she would take that moment to attack some Democratic members of Congress with unfounded conspiracy theories. And she did it from the House floor. And here's the thing I really want you to see. I want you to see this response to what Congresswoman Boebert did. This is from a leading anchor at 9 News Denver back home in Colorado. Just watch this.
Representative Lauren Boebert launched an Islamophobic attack against fellow Congresswoman Ilhan Omar on the House floor today, suggesting that the Congresswoman from Minnesota is involved in terrorism, calling her a member of the Jihad Squad, and repeating an unsupported smear that Omar had married her brother.
The Jihad Squad member from Minnesota has paid her husband, and not her brother husband, the other one, over $1 million in campaign funds. This member is allowed on the Foreign Affairs Committee while praising terrorists.
It's time that we acknowledge something that may be obvious by now. We hold Republican Congresswoman Lauren Boebert to a different standard than every other elected official in Colorado. We hold Congresswoman Boebert to a far lower standard. If we held her to the same standard as every other elected Republican and Democrat in Colorado, we would be here near nightly chronicling the cruel, false, and bigoted things that Boebert says for attention and fundraising. This is not about politics, assuming politics is still about things like taxes, national security, healthcare, jobs, and public lands. This is about us as journalists, recognizing that we'll hold a politician accountable if they say something vile once, but we won't do it if they do it every day. Our double standard is unfair to all the elected officials in Colorado, Republicans and Democrats, who display human decency.
Remarkable commentary about Congresswoman Lauren Boebert that she's facing back home in Colorado. Joining us now is 9 News Denver anchor Kyle Clark. He's the managing editor and anchor of Next with Kyle Clark, where he made that commentary this week. Mr. Clark, thanks for making time to be here tonight. I know you've got a really, really busy night.
Rachel, thanks for the invitation.
I feel like as soon as I saw that, I wanted to talk to you about it because I feel like you have hit something that has been driving me crazy for a long time, which is the last point that you made. If we'll hold the politician accountable if they say something vile once, but we won't do it if they do it every day. And the reason, of course, as you know, the reason we don't do that is because of the word new in news. It becomes the same old thing with some members of Congress, with some elected officials, with some people who have made that their stock in trade. I wanted to know if you felt like you had a proposed solution to this in addition just to the diagnosis.
I don't have a proposed solution. We have some ideas, and we're engaging our community in Colorado to find a better way forward. But it seemed to me like we could no longer wait to acknowledge the problem until we had a solid solution. Because the problem, the fact that we will hold an elected official accountable if they say something vile once, but so long as somebody is willing to make it their personality, we'll just kind of bake it into the cake. That is deeply corrosive to the way that our communities function, the communities that we serve. And even if we're not sure what the answer is, we need to acknowledge the double standard so that we can do something about it.
Right. And I do think it's really smart of you and really insightful to point out that this is unfair to people who comport themselves in a decent way, that if they said something once that was vile, then the all the attention, all the opprobrium would come down on them, whereas all you have to do to avoid that is to say it all the time. It also creates, I think, a sort of cycle in which members of Congress, other elected officials, people in the public sphere who realize that they benefit from always being off, over the edge, always being, in the words that you put it, cruel, false, bigoted things. Those folks know that they create a dilemma for the local news, for the national news, into whether or not to even cover these remarks, whether or not to play them. Because, I mean, even in your commentary, playing Congresswoman Boebert's speech, you, in effect, repeated the claims that she made against Congresswoman Omar, which are false claims. But you can't talk about and criticize what she said without also advancing advancing the thing that she's trying to spread.
And I think, Rachel, the elected officials who do this, and there are very few of them in Colorado at least, know exactly what they're doing. That it doesn't matter if we put something on television and say it's false, they still have the opportunity to get it out there. It doesn't matter if we put it out and say it's bigoted, they still get to put it out there. So the trick for us going forward, and I think the challenge for a lot of local journalists covering elected officials and members of Congress, is to figure out how do we report on what they're saying if it's cruel or false or bigoted without just relentlessly amplifying it, but also without simply ignoring it. So for us at 9 News, the NBC station in Colorado, we've gone public with the double standard to acknowledge how it benefits politicians like Congresswoman Boebert, who is willing to say things that aren't true or are bigoted or are cruel, and at the same time is unfair to all of the other public servants who choose to hold themselves to a higher standard.
And in so doing, and in doing it in the way that you have, I think you've started a really, really important conversation that's important not only in locations where there are individual politicians playing that game, but for all of us who are trying to think about how to responsibly, accurately, and effectively cover what is literally news. Kyle Clark, KUSA anchor, the managing editor of Next with Kyle Clark. Kyle, I really appreciate you making time to join us, and congratulations on starting this conversation. I think it's I think it's brilliant, and I think you've done a great job. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be right back. Stay with us. Heads up, this Monday, we're going to have a Supreme Court day. Monday is the first decision day where we'll actually get rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court for this term. Now, the most high-profile case in which we're waiting for a ruling is the Texas abortion ban. The abortion ban, which has been in place since September in Texas. It is possible that we could get a ruling on that on Monday. And then, of course, it's only the following week that the Supreme Court is going to hear arguments on a Mississippi abortion case, which is designed to just wholesale overturn Roe versus Wade altogether. So this is all going to happen fast now. For what it's worth, this was the new Washington Post ABC News poll that came out on the subject this week. Americans believe the Supreme Court should uphold Roe versus Wade, uphold the right to abortion access by a more than 2-to-1 margin. Support for abortion rights cuts across all demographics and divides. The pollsters wrote, quote, majorities of men and women, young adults and seniors, college grads and those without degrees, whites and racial and ethnic minorities all want Roe to be left in place. The findings are also, quote, steady across urban, suburban and rural residents. Americans do not want Roe versus Wade overturned. They want abortion rights upheld by the court. Nevertheless, abortion rights are teetering on a knife's edge like never before. These important cases pending before the court, we could get that one decision as soon as Monday morning. Watch this space. Man, what a day. What a week it has been. That is going to do it for us, at least for this second. I'll see you again on Monday night.
The Rachel Maddow Show, weeknights at 9 Eastern on MSNBC.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.